So I just want to expand a little bit further from what we worked on this morning. And now that you've had an opportunity to practice some, those of you who have been on retreat before, probably somewhat familiar with the drill. And then those of you who are new, it's a big move, a big shift oftentimes going from sitting 20 minutes a day to 30 minutes a day. You have, in one day, you're already like 5 hours in. It's a lot of moments to be with. And the mind, body, the organism, our being, if you will, doesn't necessarily like that so much. So that is a way in which we can try to recognize and just have some general acceptance towards that reality, towards this is not something that the organism cares for so much. And also not getting overwhelmed about thinking of like, okay, there's a half a day today and another whole day tomorrow. And the whole, like, what was I thinking? This was a totally, totally bad idea. It's good to have a sense of humor about that shit. So the reason why that's the case often is because of these bodies. Really what we're doing is a very embodied practice. The mind does not have its typical plethora of distractions, immediate gratification strategies, and the way to kind of take us out of the body. So we're really coming into a much fuller awareness of being. And I believe it's true, and it's definitely taught in the Buddhist tradition that there is a sense of well-being in the body. There is an innate quality of goodness, of ease, of well-being. But the problem, what makes it so hard, is that we sit, we breathe, we pay attention, and then we kind of get into this first layer of the pain of the body, the discomfort of the body. And really, I think that we carry a lot of our suffering, and to some degree, a big aspect of our woundedness in our bodies. There's this very famous book on trauma called The Body Keeps the Score. And the body also doesn't have linear. The body doesn't do linear. The body doesn't do past, it doesn't do future. It doesn't know that some of the worst things that you've been through, some of your biggest struggles in life happened 5, 10, 15 years ago. The body actually doesn't know any of that information. So when we try to drop awareness out of the abstract thinking mind, out of the craving and the fear and the fixing and the controlling and the better moment finding, and we kind of, you know, there can be what we call dukkha or dissatisfaction or difficulty. That just, we're really confronted with kind of that idea very existentially in a very real way. And then we kind of try to bring the awareness to that, hopefully bring some bottom-up kindness, ease to that. And that's actually a very transformative way of going about things. That's actually where this word we use sometimes called transformation, is that something kind of, there's an alchemy in that, there's a kind of mind-body process that can happen in that moment. And actually the thing about it that's probably most pragmatic and I actually think very encouraging is that actually can only happen right now. That's only a present time experience opportunity. You can only really do that in a present moment. Because the body doesn't do past and future anyway, and there's a way in which awareness integrates, holistic awareness, where the mind, the awareness of mind, the activity of mind, the to-do of mind, cools down to some degree. And in Tibetan Buddhism, there's this thing called the subtle body, which is kind of this sensation, emotion experience, the emotion in the body. That becomes more available. So one of the byproducts of practicing in this way is you start to have access to emotion. And that's, you know, that can go either way. That's not always what we want. We don't always want to have access to emotion. I know that I don't. I have a list, I have a drop-down menu of emotions I would like to access, and I have another drop-down menu of emotions I would like to discharge. Right. And that's basically what we do, is we try to kind of figure out how we can sort things out in a way to make that work, and that's actually not very possible. And so then we kind of become more awareness into this body experience. And we have to deal with the dissatisfaction of kind of just sitting here, no distraction. Just the mild to severe pain of the body, and my back hurts, my leg hurts, I'm tired, it's cold, it's warm. And as an object, so if we're just using that as an object, the practice becomes very dry. Body awareness, mind-body awareness, gotta cultivate mind-body awareness. Mindfulness of breathing awareness, pay attention to breathing. There's no heart in that. There's just sort of this dry technique-based strategy towards practice. Which is why I'm spending a lot of time, and we'll spend a lot of time, talking about how do we bring metta to that? How do we actually transform that experience in what we would call a relational field? But it's a lot easier to find the breath when you're like, okay, I hear you. I found my in-breath, I found my out-breath. Where is this metta kind of relational field thing? You know, where's the switch for that one? You thought being with the breath was hard. Now we're trying to move into something that's probably got a component to it that is nonverbal. There's a nonverbal element to metta, to kindness, to friendliness, to all the Brahma Vihara. Kindness, friendliness, compassion, appreciation. You don't just kind of switch those on. So it makes us have to look or hearken in a way of being with our experience that's a little bit more. It requires a little more patience. It requires a little more willingness. It requires a putting aside to some degree of the cognitive wanting to understand or figure out or get it. I want to get it. So there's just these what I call anti-metta practices that we get into. And so what is the non-metta experience look like? And so there's some things that we have to be careful we don't place some strange expectations on the practice. And the first one is actually metta is not about feeling good. It's about feeling what's present. So we hear something like kindness or friendliness, we think, oh, that's good, I want to feel that. It's not about, you know, we say, or I oftentimes encourage people to say, and have been using this phrase, may I be at ease, for about 10 years or so. It's not about may this be easy, I really just want to sit here and I just want this whole thing to just kind of be easy. I want it to be easy and I want it to feel good. And if it was easy and felt good, then I could get into this whole transformation business. I'm pretty sure that I could. It's not that. It's not quite that. It's about being at ease or being able to cooperate with whatever the condition is in this particular context or this particular moment. May I be at ease with my leg that fall asleep? May I be at ease with the fact that my back hurts every single time I sit down? May I be at ease with, so there's a relational quality to that, because there's an object, there's an experience that's predominating awareness, so it might be pain, it might be discomfort, it might be pleasure, it might be joy, it might be a whole matrix of things. But how am I with that? Am I with it? And then that resistance kicks in, and it's like, I actually am not interested in being with this at all. I'm very interested in having to get rid of this and fix it and get rid of it. That's what I'm interested in. Right? And of course, all your tools and strategies for that have been removed. And now there's just kind of, now you have this opportunity to work with the space between this hand and this hand. This kind of, this is what's happening. This is my awareness. And can I be more cooperative, at ease with this experience? Now, and there's a whole school of Dharma practice that would say that that actually can be a practice in and of itself. That can be just a whole way of working with the mind-body process, is just kind of working with that relational quality. And, you know, if that feels elusive or too much, then we can use the cognitive mindfulness skills of, okay, just monitoring the breath, being with the body, and not getting sucked into or giving into the mind, thinking mind. Because when we bring awareness into this pain body, into this aspect of the experience where the pain and the discomfort and the well-being also is too, but the first layer of it, usually we get the pain, the discomfort, we get the non-linear woundedness, the experiences of our life that we still don't feel good about, that lurk somewhere below the surface. That we actually have to not go to thinking mind, not go to thinking mind. You know, and kind of and create this stability of awareness. And kind of, no, stay with it, stay with it. I really don't want to stay with it, I really don't want to stay with it. Stay with it, stay with it, stay with it. And then what happens over time is this inherent sense of well-being starts to come to that through the concentration, through the awareness, and also through the quality of metta, the sense of I'm at ease with this. It's also not about liking everything. This happens to many people I know who identify as Buddhists or become interested in Buddhism. They think they have to like everything now. You maybe have met some of those people there. They really put my practice to the test. It's not about liking. It's not about feeling good. It's not about being perfect. It's not about doing it right. And that's a big one, is that we want to go on the retreat and I want to understand the instructions, I want to do them right, I got to get it right, do the right thing. That whole line of conditioning and thinking and attitude is so problematic to the practice we're trying to do here. Because if you think about it, like, what, if we're really honest, what is doing it right? Doing it right means it feels good and I'm comfortable. That's right. You ever have one of those meditations where you get up and you're like, oh, that was a good one. Why was it a good one? Because it was pleasant and you were comfortable. Right? That's why it was good. You don't get up and think, oh man, that was so much pain. That was a good one. I just sat through all this pain and discomfort and sadness. I just was with the sadness. That was a good one. You think, oh, that sucked. Oh, I don't have to do that one again. And ironically, that was probably a more productive sit, actually. People would say that to me before I go on retreat. I hope you have a good retreat. I'm like, I hope I totally don't have a good retreat. I hope I learn some shit. I don't want to just sit there and have a pleasant, neutral retreat. Mm-hmm. For about 5 years, I had these series of retreats that were mostly neutral and pleasant. And I was so frustrated. I was like, I am not getting anything. I'm like, what am I avoiding? I'm like, am I in that much denial? I can't get her suffer, goddammit. The mind just wants the other. If it's the suffering retreat, I want it to be pleasant. If it's the pleasant retreat, I want it to be the suffering retreat. It's like, I just cannot win with my mind. So there's a lot of unlearning that needs to happen. And that I believe very strongly that the basics are the best. It's the basics, it's the basic strategies, it's the sitting with, it's the being present, it's the coming back, it's the tolerance, that actually those are the skills that actually will matter most as you go through practice, whether you practice for recently practiced, practicing for years, it doesn't matter. And watching out for this, you know, metta feeling of like, I need to like this, I need this to, and watching out for the judgment that arises in association with that. Because I know that as soon as my meditative attitude starts to take on this, I'm not doing it right, then the judgment just gets in there and says, yeah, you're absolutely totally not doing this right. And then think of all the other things in your life that you're not doing very good at either. And the judgment and the fear and the craving. So it's actually not a thing as much as it's a way of seeing. And so it's a way of seeing the world, and it's a way of seeing ourselves. Because if you think about it, if you really watch the mind, there, every moment the mind frames up the moment and says, oh, and I love this phrase we use, it right now it's like this. The mind is always framing things up. It's like this, it's like this, it's like this. And we want to try to look, we want to have a worldview, a self-view that is rooted in a kindness. And so maybe I should kind of, what is that, right? What is that as an actionable item? We know, we probably think more of friendliness or kindness as a noun of something to have, but what's the verbal component of metta? This thing that I've been traveling for the last 2 weeks, and I've been at lots of airports, and I don't like the airport so much. So I try to practice metta at the airport. And one of my favorite things to do at the airport is when the people get picked up. If you stand on the curb, it's like hundreds of people who are just strung out and aggravated and impatient. And you look at people's faces and you can just see the sort of despair and distraught. And the like, just lack of just, but it's so amazing to watch. I love to. I always put my sunglasses on so people don't think I'm staring at them. But when the person's ride gets there, and you see them make contact with the friend or the loved one who's picking them up, if you can just see this metta, just like light switch on. Like this guy who looked like maybe even an aggressive, angry guy. I'm like, well, that guy's intense. And then his family comes to get him, and it's like. It's just like the whole mind-body system just kind of like, and I'm just like, that dude just got a metta blast. And I just watch. And it's like, it happens to everybody. Everybody gets it. I've never seen anybody have their ride come and go. You know, ever. You know? So what is that? We've all had that. We have that often. That's why I don't like this translation of the word metta as loving kindness. I think that sets us up, I think that makes the task even more of an uphill battle. This idea that we should love everything or love everybody, I think is very unrealistic. And actually, from the etymological understanding of metta, metta actually means friend. It means friendly. It actually means to swell up. It means to sort of swell up with metta, and that's why I love seeing this thing at the airport, because it's like you people almost like, it's like they almost inflate a little bit when they see the people that are there to pick them up, and I'm like, that's metta. It's just like boom, you go right down the line, right? And it's not even about Dharma or Buddhism, it's just about being human. Like, they don't know that they're like, oh, I just got a free hit of metta. I did a big metta bong rip, you know, just like, you know. But it happens. It happens for people. It happens to us all the time. We don't recognize it. We usually don't notice it. We don't clock that, or we don't track that. And it's about actually attending. So there's an attentional component to metta. It's to be with. So again, it draws heavily on mindfulness resources. On cognitive, mental training. So for metta to actually be enacted, it requires a fairly large deal of attention. And then it's to attend, but also with an interest. So we could say metta as a verbal component, as an actionable item, as something that one can do, is to pay attention with interest. Which is exactly what friendliness is. Why do you like to sit down and talk to your friends? Because they pay attention to you and they're interested in what you have to say. Have you sat down to talk to somebody who doesn't seem very interested in what you're talking about or saying? That doesn't feel so good. So there's that. It's very easy to see it in a relational field in terms of, you know, the image of people at the airport or us sitting with a friend and holding that gaze and paying attention and feeling that I'm interested in you, I'm interested in you. Tell me more, tell me more, tell me more. Now, we could be talking about something very, very unpleasant, very, very painful, very, very difficult, but that friendliness would still be able to tend and to be interested with that experience, regardless of it feeling good. So the practice or the question becomes, how do we learn how to kind of turn that in inward seeing in sort of a metta vipassana way? How do we bring that into our own experience? And this really, if when we're able to do this, it really destroys and certainly undermines our the way we're dictated by our pleasure-pain dichotomy. The object, whether the object is pleasant or unpleasant or agreeable or disagreeable, from the view of metta, is actually totally irrelevant. It doesn't matter. And it removes any sense of ill will, wanting to harm, which also, in an internal sense, would be the removal of something like self-judgment, that I'm not good at this, this isn't good, I'm no good. The ill will, that's the ill will. Self-judgment has that kind of sharpness to it, that harshness to it, that judgmental, condescending, patronizing, almost self-contempting. It just undermines and just gets right at that. It undermines and gets at the sense of blaming. Well, this retreat would probably be pretty good, but in some way, the moment that's unpleasant is like my fault. I'm existentially responsible. You know, really, it gets away at this kind of experience, maybe strong language, but I feel like sometimes there can be a feeling or a sense of some inner violence. And so if that's happening, we're finding that to be happening, then this kind of just bland mindfulness of object, mindfulness of breathing, just come back to the breath, just come back. It's that whole type of training becomes, to some degree, almost unbearable, intolerable. So there's a way we have to be able to, in any particular moment or experience, we want to be able to be skilled in both of these camps, so that way we can know in any particular moment where we might want to be leaning our awareness or our intentionality or our attention. So for me, if I'm practicing and I'm just sitting with my body and my breath, and I start to feel activated, the concentration is not solidifying into mindfulness. It's not solidifying into being whole or holistic. It's actually becoming activated around something in the body that's not okay. Maybe it's emotional, maybe it's just pain, discomfort, maybe there's a memory associated with that. And then I get kind of a little bit of a yellow flag goes off in my practice and says, you need to switch or you need to draw more heavily into metta right now. It's like, oh man, this is hard, this is painful. And that allows mindfulness to come back online. If there's a sense of ease there, then you can start to be like, well, you know, it's just one of many sits, it will be over at some point, I can sit here, I can be with this pain, I can be with this discomfort. And it gets us out of that black and white, like, it's always like this, it's always going to be like this, I'm stuck like this, it's going to be, the whole retreat's going to be like this, I know it. You do? How do you know? My mind told me. My bully mind. my mean, bully, aggressive, super ego. Just letting me have it right now. So we can see that that's not conducive, so that we have to be able to recognize that, see that happening and shift. So for this practice, we're not going to do much different than what we did this morning, but we're going to do something that I call embodied metta, which is really trying to bring a deeper awareness into the body. Also using a technique that I use often that was taught to me by Ajahn Sachita, who's a Thai forest master. Very simple language around softening and widening. So how do we soften and widen? Those would be good tattoo knuckles, wouldn't it? Soft and wide. This is the kind of shit I think on about when I'm on retreat. Like, I went on this retreat, I got the best idea for tattoo knuckles. It was totally worth it. But so softening is a sense of, is the metta aspect of it, the quality of feeling through the body. So we'll do a kind of a heavy body scan, recognizing where tension and tightness is being held, and soften that, releasing tension. Also, softening is very much associated with breathing. If you really watch and observe and feel, breathing is very soft. The in-breath is from the moment it begins, there's a soft, it's the texture of breathing is very, very soft. It's the air element. It's very easy, actually. So there's a way in which we can soften the body, soften the mind, soften the heart by just focusing on breathing as a sort of elemental aspect. Physics class. The physics, sensation, feeling, softening. Because the mind isn't soft at all. Thinking isn't soft. Thinking is like a typewriter from the 50s. Gotta do this, gotta do that, you better do this, gotta do that. Oh my God, what do you know about this, what do you know about that? This sucks. Why am I like this, why am I like that? I'm a person who's like this, I'm always doing this, why? It's just like writing the worst novel ever. Like Russian existential prose. A Dostoevsky novel in my own head. Crime and Punishment. Present time. How bad can we think about this moment? Right? You know what I'm talking about. We don't want to encourage that. So there's a way where we can soften and we can use this metta attitude and just kind of watching that. So when we do that, and I'll try to integrate that, so as we breathe in, as we soften, we're just kind of trying to incline the mind towards softening, easiness, kindness, friendliness, in-breath, texture, physics, soft, 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 releasing tension in the body if it's there. And then widening is really about the mind, is about wide. We want the mind to be wide. We want the view to be as open and complete as humanly possible. We don't want this kind of myopic view. Of like, well, it's always like this. I'm always like that. Pain in my leg. This is going to be the pain in my leg retreat. I know it. I know it. Myopic, tight, so wide. And so we can use sound. Sound is a very reliable, useful. It doesn't get talked about so much, unfortunately, as a meditation practice, especially outside where the soundscape is quite deep. So you can focus your... Is there an airplane above us? It's pretty far away. How much space is there between the top of my head and that airplane? That's wide. All the way up there. So we can let our mind, we can kind of go wide out through the seats, through the hearing doors. I get some width. I need some width. I need some space. I don't want to create meditator's claustrophobia. Wide, soft. And that's awareness. That's the cultivation of awareness. It's wide. Open. Monitoring. Above the thoughts. So as far and wide as we can send that. So as we breathe in, we can create the experience of softness by recognizing something that is soft, like breathing, the attitude that we have about that. And then as we breathe out, we can widen, we can let the breath go out into the open space, let the ears go out into the soundscape, and see if you can even try it right now, see if you can notice what sound is furthest away from where we're sitting right now. Brings me way out of my myopic self-view, so I don't hear it. Softening and widening. So if you like, you can maybe just stand if you want to stretch your body a little bit before we do the practice. And then at the end of this practice, I'll save some time. We'll have for some Q&A. Thank you.